Nicaragua, a once peaceful nation, is in turmoil. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Skirmishes continue. This week, four more people died as security forces have pushed protesters back near the capital. Today is also the anniversary of the 1979 Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua. Plus, Edward Villela is a well-known dancer and coach in the ballet world. His departure from South Florida made headlines, but he's back with a new troupe of dancers. And
in the town where I was born,
this is the 50th anniversary of an iconic Miami Beach theater. We'll look back at some of the historical moments for the space that's become O Cinema. We'll also explain why we're hearing the Beatles' Yellow Submarine. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, this past week, reports are four more people died in Masaya, Nicaragua, between security forces and the group calling for the removal of the current president, Daniel Ortega. Now, the latest deaths come as the government claims it's taken back a protester stronghold in the Masaya neighborhood of Monimbo. Roughly 300 people have been killed since the protests began. There are calls from the international community for the president to do something to stop the violence. A lot of criticism of Ortega right now. We're joined by WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you, Lewis.
Latest news, government forces retaking this. It's not rebel stronghold, it's protester stronghold in this community. Four dead. Is this significant?
Yes. Well, symbolically significant in a unfortunately deadly way. Masaya is a very symbolic city in Nicaragua because back in the 70s, it was one of the strongholds that the Sandinista rebels used to bring down the right-wing dictator Anastasio Somoza. Now, let's fast forward today. The protesters who are calling for the removal of President Daniel Ortega, who was the leader of the Sandinista rebels back in 1979 when they brought down Somoza, they symbolically took over Masaya, and in particular this neighborhood of Masaya, Monimbo, which was, you know, the rebel stronghold back then. They took over this area as a symbolic show to Ortega that, look, we're now bringing you down, or want to bring you down, because you've become just the same kind of dictator that Somoza was a generation ago. And because this week marks the big anniversary of that rebel achievement back in 1979 of bringing down Somoza, Ortega was very, very intent on clearing that city, and particularly the neighborhood of Monimbo, out to symbolically show that he was taking things over again.
These are not rebels. They're protesters.
Right. This is not, I mean, when you say rebel, that tends to connotate armed guerrillas trying to overthrow the regime. Granted, these protesters, these opponents of Ortega, want to see him removed from office. But I don't think technically we can yet call them rebels. They're really not an armed group.
Who are they?
They are really quite a broad coalition of students, elderly Nicaraguans, people who feel that Ortega has really just trashed democracy in their country and has created a sort of a family fiefdom there, a dictatorship, a corrupt dictatorship at that, and they're tired of it, and they're calling, if not for his removal, at least for early elections so that they can remove him in the ballot box.
And you mentioned this is the anniversary of that Sandinista revolution. Right, is what you call it.
Sandinista revolution. Yeah.
I mean, can you compare what's happening today to what did happen almost 40 years ago?
In some ways, yes. Anastasio Somoza was a very brutal right-wing dictator, and he in many ways trashed the country. And the Sandinistas, that's what they were rising up against, as I said, you know, back in that generation. Today, we didn't really know how brutal Ortega could be until protesters started calling for his removal back in April, which that those protests started as a result of a Social Security reform that he tried to ram through, which would have raised payments that people have to put into the pension system, but yet at the same time reduce the payout for elderly citizens. And that's where that coalition of students and elderly people came from. When they started protesting and Ortega started trying to put down the protests in April, we really got a look at just how vicious his security forces and, more important, these paramilitary goons that he has in his employ known as Turbas can be. I mean, the human rights groups report that they have killed more than 300 protesters since April.
Let's remind people, too, that he was in charge and then they elected him out and then came back.
Right.
And won another election.
Okay, and this is, again, what this is all about. As you point out, after the Sandinistas overthrew Somoza in 1979, Ortega became president. This was his first presidency, which lasted all through the 1980s, and it was essentially a Marxist dictatorship. But because of the civil war that was happening in the 80s between the Contras, as you recall, who were against Ortega and his army, eventually in 1990, with the backing of Ronald Reagan, the U.S. president back then, Ortega, in that election in 1990, was thrown out of office. And his whole life since then has been an attempt to win retribution, revenge, if you will, for what happened to him in 1990. He came back, made a political comeback in 2006 and was elected president again. And since then, he has done everything he can to dismantle democracy in Nicaragua. He's turned the Supreme Court into a banana republic bench, you know, for filled with his supporters. He has gotten term limits eliminated so that he can run for president for as long as he wants the rest of his life. His wife is his vice president. And everything he has done since he took power again in 2006 has been really to get revenge for what happened to him in 1990.
There are over 100,000, I think is what the census data showed, Nicaraguans living here in South Florida.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a big population here.
I mean, you know, the ones you've spoken to, what are they saying about what's going on right now and how often they get back home or talk to people back home? I mean, what are they saying?
What they're saying is they're not surprised by what's happened. When Ortega was elected again in 2006, there was a lot of talk about how, he's going to vindicate himself. He's going to show that he's a changed man, that he's not the same sort of incompetent Marxist that he was back in the 1980s. And to a certain extent, early on in his presidency, there was a change in him. He allowed capitalism to flourish. The economy, which is one of the worst in the Western Hemisphere, began to show signs of being something more than a basket case. But at the same time, as I said, while business people in Nicaragua were starting to enjoy themselves, he was, at the same time, just dismantling democracy in the country. And it wasn't really up until this year that the country sort of woke up to that. And that's why we're seeing the big protests now.
And something else, too, that was interesting is that reading, I mean, Nicaragua, when you think about some of the other countries in Central America, relatively a peaceful country, at least the last few years.
Right. That was one of Ortega's other achievements in this new presidency of his, was that he was able to insulate Nicaragua from the ravages of the drug gang violence that has really just torn apart the countries to the north of Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, known as the Northern Triangle. So that was another thing that sort of lulled people into letting Ortega trash democracy in Nicaragua because they felt that the economy and the security situation was okay. But everything has its limits, and that limit was reached in this year. That was the breaking point.
What is the relationship between Nicaragua and the United States right now? How would you describe it?
In fact, we're going to be hearing from the State Department today about what what next steps they plan to take in Nicaragua. But right now, the United States is being sort of careful about it's applying some targeted economic sanctions against top Ortega officials whom it feels have been responsible for this really vicious security force response to the protests. But we haven't really seen the kind of response from the United States government that, for example, the expats here in South Florida would like to see. They'd like to see a stronger response from the United States. But the United States right now, for example, has a lot of its political capital in the hemisphere wrapped up in trying to get the Venezuelan regime, you know, to clean up its act. So I think we're going to see more. But I think right now you're going to see a lot more pressure being put on from the expat Nicaraguan expat community here in South Florida, which ironically many of them here were political, you know, are the children of political
from
prisoners
the
under
revolution.
Somoza, you know. There's a lot of irony built in there that a lot of the people who are opposing Ortega also, you know, maybe their parents and grandparents were opposing Somoza at the same time, you know, that Ortega was bringing him down back in 1979.
We're talking with WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett, talking about the situation right now in Nicaragua. As we reported this past week, the Nicaraguan government has they have stated that their security forces have taken a protester stronghold near the capital. Four people have been reported dead. One of them was a police officer, again, in the reports that we have seen. You know what? I just wanted to mention real quickly, because we keep talking about the relationship between the United States and Nicaragua. Vice President Mike Pence recently tweeted out, state-sponsored violence against peaceful students, church leaders, journalists, and civic leaders in Nicaragua cannot be tolerated. Ortega's repression must end, and the will of the people must be heard. What are we hearing in that tweet? Are we hearing from the United States and other leaders in the Western Hemisphere, from the international community, that Ortega has to go? Or are they asking him to clean it up?
First, they're asking him to stop the violence. As I said, we've all just been astonished at how brutal the response of Ortega's security forces, and again, these paramilitary thugs known as Turbas, just how brutal their response has been to the protesters, who are largely unarmed. It's as if Ortega has, you know, dug in his heels and said, no, we are not going to tolerate any kind of dissent here in this way, and we're going to exterminate it. And so far, he's been able to get away with it. And so finally, we're seeing the U.S., the U.N., the international community saying, look, if you don't step down, at least stop this brutality that we're seeing on the part of your security forces. And then after that, we'll see if mediation can maybe convince him to accept early elections.
And I believe church leaders have tried to
jump in to
mediate.
The Catholic Church is trying to mediate. You've got to understand, though, that just like the business community in Nicaragua, the Catholic Church often made kind of a questionable pact with Ortega. You know, he backed their agenda. Nicaragua has one of the toughest anti-abortion laws in the world. And so, you know, the Catholic Church was also sort of lulled to sleep by Ortega, because he protected their agenda. And now all of a sudden, they too, just like the business community, are starting to wake up and realize, wow, this guy is quite a despot.
You did a story recently. You talked with a Nicaraguan activist, Felix Maradiaga.
Maradiaga.
He went back to Nicaragua.
Right.
Why?
He's a leading human rights activist. About a month ago, you know, during the protests, Ortega made it clear that they wanted to arrest him. They accused him of being the person who was responsible for all this anti-government unrest. And so to sort of, you know, escape arrest, he came here in Miami to sort of rally support amongst the expats here. But he decided he had to go back. He decided he had to go back to try to help not just the protesters, but mediate some kind of solution.
And somebody, here. They attacked him.
And last week, he was beaten up in the city of León by these members of these goon squads known as the Turbas. He was hospitalized for a few days, and then his supporters flew him back out. And as far as I know, he's in Washington right now trying to rally more congressional support against Ortega there on Capitol Hill.
We see this unrest. Obviously, there's the Venezuela situation, and then, of course, Haiti recently. Mm-hmm. What do you see happening, you know, in Nicaragua? If the international community is putting pressure on him at least to stop the violence, but it seems like mm-hmm. he just wants to tighten his grip on the country. I mean, what happens now?
Well, I think we're seeing two things. One is, we're seeing a response amongst populations in countries like Nicaragua against this growing trend of, and let's say the growing revival, because Latin America has always been a region of strong men, right? Dictators and populist strong men. I think we're seeing people in countries like Nicaragua reacting against that. We saw it in Venezuela. We've been seeing it in Venezuela, for example. And I think, you know, we're also seeing it now in Haiti, where they tried to impose this rather draconian fuel hike on a country that's the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. So I think it's unfortunate to see this kind of violent unrest. But on the other hand, maybe there's a silver lining in the sense that we're seeing these populations push back against a very troubling trend in Latin America. As I said, the revival of strongmen.
And by the way, isn't it their Nicaraguan's TPS is coming to an end?
Yes.
Correct.
Right.
So now you have a lot of Nicaraguans who are going to have to probably go back.
Right. And that's, they're going to be going back to a very, violent situation.
But with what's happening right now, do you think that could change the U.S.'s position, that the State Department would say, okay, you know what, we can extend the TPS because, well, things are starting to get bad again?
I doubt it. The Trump administration has made it very clear that it's very adamant about ending TPS. They feel that the temporary protected status has been made a mockery of, that it's turned into permanent. So I don't think they're going to bend on that. If they're not going to extend it for Haitians, for example, which is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, I don't see them extending it for Nicaragua, unfortunately.
WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett joining us, talking and giving us an update on what's going on in Nicaragua, a country that is falling deeper into turmoil. Tim, as always, a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right, still to come, he's been called one of the greatest male dancers of our generation. He's returned to Miami with a new dance troupe. That's all next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, today the Miami City Ballet is one of America's leading companies in the dance world. The company is over 30 years old and was founded by one of America's great male ballet dancers, Edward Villela. In 1986, Villela founded the company with Toby Lerner Anson and became the founding artistic director. He based the school and its teaching on practices and style that he learned from George Balanchine, who was his director his whole dancing career. Villela was essential to the Miami City Ballet's worldwide recognition, including a series of performances in Paris in 2011. The following year, he was asked to leave the company by the board. Now, he's back in Miami to coach ballet for the first time since his departure. He's going to be coaching the dancers at Dimensions Dance Theater of Miami and two George Balanchine ballets, Tarantella and Tchaikovsky's Pas de Deux, for a show this Saturday. Now, we spoke to Villela for the ballet studios of Dimensions Dance Theater of Miami.
It feels wonderful coaching these gorgeous young people, and it is my great pleasure to pass on knowledge. Great genius named George Balanchine. He said, you know what ballet is? It's a passing art form. You pass it body to body, but more importantly, you pass it mind to mind.
You played an essential role in forming the Miami City Ballet 30 years ago. Take us back to that time. Was there an appetite in this area for that institution?
Well, the appetite was rather slim, but I understood that. I've been around this stuff many, many years, and it's not easily achieved. It takes time, and it takes a great deal of patience. And I was uninterested in bringing in the 19th century. But I had come from this genius, George Balanchine, and his great pal and composer, Igor Stravinsky. So my whole purpose of making that company was to celebrate the legacies of Balanchine and Stravinsky. And it's very complicated to get an audience to buy into this, because they're so used to going to ballets that have stories. So they read this story and they figure, okay, I know enough. No. The 19th century showed us where it all began. Then the invention has to continue. And that's what it is. And that's why guys like me are somewhat in demand, because we have the training and background and knowledge from geniuses, and we then try to pass it on.
And you talk about where it all begins, and I wanted to know, where did it all begin for you? How did you get interested in ballet?
My mother was an orphan, and she had not had much opportunity. I had a sister who was a year older than I was, and my mother was focused on giving her opportunity. She was giving my sister any and every kind of lesson, including ballet lessons. I used to hang out in the streets and get into physical trouble. And one day I got knocked unconscious by a baseball while my mother was away with my sister, and I got dragged home unconscious. Then I got up, got in the house, but a neighbor had seen this and then told my mother. My mother got very upset, and she said, "That's it. From now on, we can't trust you on the streets anymore. Every time your sister goes to a class, you're coming with us." And I went, "Oh, my God, oh, this is awful." So I went, and I sat, and I watched, and I got so bored. And suddenly, they started to jump, and then I went in the back of the room, and I started to fly around and jump, and I basically disrupted the class. So at the end of it, the teacher went up to my mother and said, "Get him out of here, or put him in tights at the bar." And the next day, I was in tights at the bar.
You talked about George Balanchine's influence on you a couple of times. You mentioned his name, and he was your mentor throughout your work in New York. Describe the influence that he had on the art form and how it continues to influence dancers, but you as well today.
He basically changed the face of his art form, but so did Stravinsky. I mean, what Stravinsky invented, what Balanchine invented to Stravinsky's invention, is absolutely historic and masterful. Those two guys provided us with 35 masterworks. And what my intention is always to do is to show the inside of what this stuff is and how you can move it forward. We have to take care of the field. We have to move the field forward on an ongoing basis. So we can't constantly go back to the 19th century and the Giselles. And yes, we need to do all of those things. We need to know all of that. But we also have to have a full understanding of where the field can fully develop and continue to develop.
When I think about performers, I wondered how many you had here in Miami who were Latin, and, you know, what did they bring when, you know, especially the Cubans, what did they bring to, you know, to the training?
Well, like anybody else, they brought their upbringing, their understanding, where they came from, all of those things. But the important thing here is not just to have a Cuban to show us Cuban background and experience. It's the entire field that they have to represent. And that was always the complication, because the Cubans were brought up by the Russians. And the Russians, all they knew was the 19th century. So all of those Cuban dancers who came to the Miami City Ballet had to retrain. So it's a question of this willingness. And if you can get people to the point where they get excited about change, change is definitely terrifying thing. It's either terrifying or it's amazing. I've never been afraid. I've always wanted to know more.
I'm speaking with Edward Villela. He was the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet for more than 40 years and was the key to the ballet's creation. He was removed in 2012 by the board, but he's back in Miami, and he's coaching the dancers that are part of Dimensions Dance. They're doing a performance this Saturday. Edward, in 2011, the Miami City Ballet was invited to perform in Paris for a special series. Why was it so important for you to bring the ballet to an international stage?
Because that's who we are. We have an international art form. And the critical issue is to be accepted in the major capitals of the world, not just here, but also. So essentially what I was attempting to do was to do a state company, then a national company, then an international company. We spent 3 weeks there. We did between 96 and 97% business. We had full houses all the time. We had standing, screaming ovations. And that just went on for 3 weeks. Again, I've been at this such a long time. I have never experienced those kinds of successes. I mean, essentially, we had a triumph in Paris. So we were presenting American neoclassicism to a place, the Paris Opera and so on, that have 300-year traditions.
You were asked to leave the company the following year. What happened?
Well, those are things I don't really talk about. I never have, never really wish to. All I can do is suggest to find what the Miami Herald said. And all I do is, when people ask me questions, it's what those people articulated in the Miami Herald. And what they said was there were a few people who wanted to make a change, and they wanted me no longer there. So, you know, this is nothing I am chagrined about. I spent 25 years there. I was grateful for that period of time, and I made us internationally accepted. So whatever it is that I did when I was here, I stand by. Whatever it was that I achieved in 25 years, nationally and internationally, has been accepted as beyond good.
What's your relationship with Dimensions Dance performers?
Oh, I love them. They're great. And, you know, what I have to say to them, they haven't heard before. So it's a wonderful thing for us to be exploring this kind of stuff, which is strictly invention for them. But they are hungry. These are people, you know, certainly a lot of Cubans here, and they now know how they were trained and how they were brought up. There's still so much more to learn to fill in the gaps up to this century.
And you told me earlier on that ballet is about passing on. And so here you are now, and basically, you know, you're passing on this legacy, especially Balanchine's work. What does that mean to you?
I respected those people so much. They opened my world to vast, vast areas. I mean, I am so grateful for what those guys did for me. And I owe a debt to those people, especially Balanchine and Stravinsky. So I have devoted my time after being a dancer at the New York City Ballet for almost 20 years to see if I could make these statements, these neoclassical statements. It took me 25 years to do it. I'm thrilled that I did it. I'm thrilled that we had great success. And whether I'm still there or not, you can't change what I did. You just have to look at it for what it is. And we were acclaimed throughout this country and throughout Europe. So I'm very pleased having accomplished something, having contributed something. And that's the most important thing we can do, is contribute to our communities.
Will this be your final performance with Dimensions Dance, or do you think there could be future performances?
Oh, anytime they ask, I will certainly come. I love these young dancers. I love working with them. But Jennifer Cronenberg and her husband, Carlos Guerra, were two of my best dancers at the Miami City Ballet. Plus, they were really the example of dancers, the best kind of example of the dancers that we brought up. So it's almost, you know, these guys to me were sort of, I viewed them as family. So I adore working now with my extended family. So anytime they ask me, I will be here.
Edward Villela, it's been an absolute pleasure. Welcome back to South Florida, and thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that was a conversation we had with Edward Villela, one of the founders of Miami City Ballet. He's back in the Magic City coaching dancers at Dimensions Dance Theater of Miami, and they are performing two George Balanchine ballets this Saturday. We'll have more information on our Facebook, WLRN Sundial. All right, still to come, it's the 50th anniversary of an iconic Miami Beach theater. We're going to talk about the significance of that theater and Miami's connection to one of the world's most famous pop bands. That's all coming up here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, 50 years ago this week, an iconic theater opened on Miami Beach. The Byron Carlyle had a rich history of bringing in some of the top Hollywood films, and in its beginning featured two massive theaters holding hundreds of seats. Back in 2014, more than a decade after the theater shut its doors, Miami's O Cinema reopened the iconic theater to the public to feature the top independent films from around the country. In celebration of the theater's 50th anniversary, O Cinema is screening the iconic cartoon film about the Beatles, Yellow Submarine. The Beatles have a unique history with the city of Miami, spending 8 days here exploring the city back in 1964.
Here come the Beatles! Here they come! Here they come! There's Ringo! Who else we have there? There's George!
There's Paul over there.
Here they come, the four Beatles!
WQAM captured their arrival live at Miami International Airport, here to discuss the history of the Byron Carlyle and give some perspective on Yellow Submarine and the Beatles' time in Miami and everything that's going on for this celebration. We're joined by Kareem Tapsch of O Cinema Miami. Kareem, great to have you back, man.
Wonderful to be here again.
All right, so take us back. Let's shoot back a little bit. This is before our time, of course. Back to 1968, what were the theater options in Miami at the time?
I mean, that's an era where theater going was so different across the world, right? You had single screen theaters. So in Miami Beach, people will remember the Carib, the Lincoln, the Colony, certainly all of those along Lincoln Road. In North Beach, you had the Surf and the Normandy, and these were all what we'd call single screen theaters. One screen, hundreds of seats, one movie showing at a time. It's changed quite a bit since then.
And it was such an event, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
You dressed up to go to the movies.
Going to the movies was a night out, you know. If you come to O Cinema now, you'll see people in shorts and flip-flops, which we welcome because it's an extension of your home. Be comfortable. But then you'd see people, gentlemen in coats and women in gloves. I mean, there's great footage of that. It was a different era, and movie going was such a really took over America, and particularly in Miami and Miami Beach. The city was littered with theaters.
Tell us about the Byron Carlyle. What was unique about it?
When the Byron Carlyle opened in 1968 as part of the Wometco Theater chain, which was the Wolfson family, which of course made huge contributions to our community, it opened as the largest theater in South Florida at the time. It was two auditoriums, one which was about 600 seats, and the other one about 700 or 800 seats. So it really kind of was a game changer from day one. You had these not just two screens, now you had double the options of movies to see.
Which is, by the way, it's just so weird to think about, because now we have these 18, 24 plex IMAX theaters,
right,
and everything. But back in the day, it was two, when you had two screens. Oh my God!
Those were the game changer. All of a sudden, you had so much more choices, right? And movies would, you know, tour around the country, and they would stay in theaters for weeks and weeks at a time. So sometimes a lot of time would go by between you going to see another one, and there was in that area. You had the Normandy and the Surf on Collins, and then the Byron Carlyle, which are three blocks away. None of them were showing the same film. So unless something new came in, it was a couple of, you know, sometimes a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months before you went to go to the movies again. So the Byron opens in 68. It's a game changer. This huge red carpet premiere with the likes of Jackie Gleason and Otto Preminger in the premiere of a film called Skidoo.
That was the first movie?
That was the first movie. The very 60s name. Hosted by a little guy known as Larry King. And this is what Larry did in the 60s in Miami. He hosted movie premieres and fashion shows in between his radio shows. And that's what kickstarted the theater as kind of an epicenter for movies in our community.
And that was in one of the theaters, right? What was in the other one?
Yeah, so actually when it opened, that film was screening across both screens.
Oh, was it?
That
okay.
Big of a deal. But the following week opened one of my personal favorites films, which is The Lion in Winter, starring Katharine Hepburn, Peter O'Toole, and Anthony Hopkins first film role, and Timothy Dalton, who later went on to become James Bond. And that film actually is so popular. I want to say it won about 7 Academy Awards. It was so popular, it played at the theater for a year.
That you just don't hear of that at all.
Absolutely not. And it's a great film. We plan to bring it back at some point later this year as part of our 50-year celebration of the theater.
All right, so let's listen to the trailer of The Lion in Winter, the second film to open at that theater.
Don't fight me, Eleanor.
What would you have me do? Give out, give up, give in?
Give me a little peace.
A little? Why so modest? How about eternal peace? Now there's a thought.
Well, what do we have? The holly or each other?
For these 10 years you've lived with everything I've lost and loved another woman through it all, I could peel you like a pear and God himself would call it justice.
Oh, I loved movie previews were just so different than what you get today. Today it's more visual, but I'm going to geek out for a second. By the way, I just have to mention that this is one of my favorite stories. It's I did watch both movies. There were two versions, but that was the first one with Peter O'Toole and Katharine Hepburn. I actually got to perform on the stage performance of Lion in Winter.
What?
So I did that years ago. I have to just geek out. I just have self-indulging. That's all. I get to play Richard, which was Anthony Hopkins' part.
Oh, wow.
It was a fun. It's such a fun movie. A really fun story. But why was that movie so significant for that era? Because as you said, it was in the theater for a year.
I mean, it was groundbreaking on so many levels. First of all, it's visually beautiful in the performances. I mean, I think you can get that across just from the bit we heard.
I mean, look at the cast.
It's you know, astounding. But, you know, it was based in history, but it was also controversial. You know, the film had a gay subtext, you know, the relationship between Anthony Hopkins' character and that of Timothy Dalton, for example. I mean, that's 1968, and it's dealt with you know, kind of very head on. So it was ahead of its time in that way. And again, those performances are so superb that, you know, it's one of those that I watch probably once every 6 months.
By the way, because you talk about the scene where Anthony Hopkins and Timothy Dalton are basically, they're having a lover's quarrel. But watch the two versions of the movie and see how they deal with that subject over a period of decades. Because I think the second version came out in the 90s. So it's a bit different. Over the next couple of decades, though, the theater featured major Hollywood films. You look through some of the old advertising from the Brandon Carlile. Give us an idea of the films that were screened there. What other kind of big movies came through?
I mean, the most iconic films of the last 50 years played at the Byron Carlile, titles like Jaws, a little film called Rocky, The Empire Strikes Back, E.T., Die Hard. All of these are movies that came through the theater. It's interesting. For those of us who grew up in Miami, the Byron Carlisle was where we went to go see movies. And you know, some of the most popular films kind of our generations came alive on those screens.
It was, what, 2001? The theater shuts down.
Yeah, the theater had, you know, goes through this kind of long history, right? So it opens with these two screens, and in the 80s, it actually gets multiplexed. So it goes from two screens to seven, and it was known for a long time as the Byron Carlisle 7. And then in 2001, the theater does close down. It's the same time that the Regal Cinema 18 in South Beach opens up. And the city of Miami Beach, with the help of a lot of activists in the community, see this piece of real estate. It's an entire block in North Beach, and say this is going to be a catalytic part of the future of this community in North Beach. And they purchase it. They partially renovate the building, so only the far eastern portion of the building has been renovated into kind of a multifunction space, full stage, you know, 300 seats across two levels. And it operates kind of as a rental house with theater troupes, dance troupes, comedians coming through and kind of sporadically doing shows in that era, in that facility. And then a local theater company, the Stage Door out of Broward, took management of the theater for about 2 years or so until one of their co-founders passed suddenly, and they stopped programming the space. And the city of Miami Beach approached us and said, can we revive this as a movie theater with the kind of unique programming that O Cinema does?
Talking with Kareem Tapp, she's the executive director of O Cinema, which are two independent movie theaters around Miami, which one of two. It's the 50th anniversary of the formerly Byron Carlisle Theater in Miami Beach, which was restored by O Cinema in 2014. And for that celebration, they're going to have a special going on this weekend, and that's why we played a little bit of, we were talking about the Beatles earlier. That's part of the celebration this weekend, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say that I'm the co-director and co-founder of O Cinema alongside Vivian Martel, who's the brains of the operation.
Thank you.
The mouth. Yes, we're celebrating another 50th anniversary, and that is the Beatles' Yellow Submarine. This version has been stunningly hand-restored. So it looks as beautiful as you'll ever have seen it.
I can admit I haven't seen that movie since I was a kid. That's going back to the maybe early 80s, late 70s.
So chances are you did not see it in great shape because, you know, back in those days what you'd have were these old film prints that would tour across the country. So with time, film prints, the colors fade, the sound goes out of whack. And what you're seeing now is a full restoration, 5.1 sound of that glorious Beatles music, and like I said, hand-restored imagery. It's colorful, it's vibrant, it's like psychedelic 60s pop coming alive in front of you. We're starting it on July 20th for a week at the Byron.
Let me come back, though, because you said something a moment ago about what was going on in that time from when the theater shut down, and I was curious, why did O Cinema want to revitalize that Byron Carlisle Theater? What was behind that?
We believe in the power of movies to change communities and change lives. It's the most accessible art form. And what we've seen in other places, particularly in Wynwood, that it, you know, it really kind of brings a really rich and diverse audience to a space. Films are, we're dedicated to entertaining, educating, and inspiring through our films. And what we like to do is revitalize the neighborhood movie theater as a concept, which we did that in Wynwood. And when we looked at North Beach and we saw this is a neighborhood, people walk, live here. Certainly there's a tourist component, but you know, there's a real sense of belonging and of community. And we knew that we could be part of that and part of this really exciting development for community. North Beach is going through some really exciting new things, you know, some new historic preservation that it was designated earlier this year. Lots of exciting development that's coming to the community, particularly with the geobomb that's coming up for vote soon. So, you know, being able to be in the crux of that and bring cultural programming 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, really was appealing to us. And the community asked us for it, actually. When the word that O Cinema was considering coming to program and manage the Byron Carlisle got out, the city commission was inundated with emails. We were inundated with emails. And the exciting thing is, you know, we bring over 27,000 people a year to the community seeing the best in independent films and going out and supporting area businesses and really kind of being a lifeline for North Beach.
And that's your focus now on independent films. Your focus on a very different type of art, unlike what the Byron was doing before.
Yes, exactly. Our focus is in independent foreign and art films. There's a million places to see the new Harry Potter movie. That, and there's a dated reference right there. Hasn't been a Harry Potter movie in a while.
Yeah, that's old now, buddy.
Yeah, I know. I'm a little out of it. But there's a million places to see all these great mainstream movies. You can go anywhere to see Ocean's 8. That's a recent one. But there's not as many options to see these great independent films. So when, you know, and that kind of speaks to the crux of why we started O Cinema, Vivian Martel and I. We would travel, spend a lot of time, myself in San Francisco, New York, Vivian in Toronto, and we would inevitably go to the movies because we wouldn't see some of these films in our community, and that seemed ludicrous to us.
When the film opened at O Cinema, filmmaker Barry Jenkins spoke with New Tropic about its importance to a Miami audience.
Yeah, you know, when Terrell's piece first came to me, it was by these kids at Borscht, and the whole thing was to have Miami natives be proud of telling their story. So I think, you know, if the film does well or people, you know, pick out the neighborhoods or the schools and things like that and take pride in it, you know, I think that would just be amazing, you know, because I think we all should be proud to be from the 305 or the 786, whatever you want to say.
Exactly.
That was such an important moment in Miami history, I think, in film history, but O Cinema got to play its part.
Yeah, absolutely. That was for Moonlight, and we were the first theater in the state to open that film. And it played at a cinema for, I think, like a record-setting 14 weeks. And we had Terrell McCraney and cast and Barry come through the theater quite often. O Cinema is one of is Terrell's home theater, so that makes it easy. But it kind of speaks to the really to what we do, which is the importance of representation. We want to represent the diverse and rich fabric of this community. And we're so proud of doing that. I think that the stories that you see coming alive at O Cinema, represent such vast communities here, whether it's the African-American experience, Latino, LGBT, Jewish. And a film like Moonlight that does that while also being so authentic to the community and being made from the community by members of the community.
So it's really interesting what you said a second ago about how when word got out that O Cinema was interested in coming in and reviving some of that old feel, that there was a push. People wanted it. And I wondered about that. We live in this age now where, well, first of all, even going to the movies is like, what for? I mean, I've got everything at home whenever I want it. But even if I do, movie theaters now are pushing so hard more on the IMAX experience, the IMAX 3D experience. Movie theaters are getting, really a lot more sophisticated in what they're offering people. It's becoming more of like a, first of all, you get big reclining seats with little tables. Menu options are bigger. They're really trying to make it an experience. So how does something like O Cinema, and I know it's not the only one in the country, but how does that thrive in this age where it seems like the customer wants so much more?
Yeah, I think that it comes down to the fact that Vivian and I, when we talk about a cinema and when every decision we make is we lead with the art. The decisions are based around, are we bringing the best and the brightest to the screen? Are we bringing films that represent the community? And what you do, there's certainly lots of VIP experiences. We offer you VIP films, is how I like to describe it. So we're not the fanciest theater in town, but you might have the best experience by coming to us. And you'll see films that resonate with you and resonate with the local community. And we do more than just show films, which is really important. You know, earlier this summer, we had the fantastic documentary RBG about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And we talked about that on the show, too.
Yeah, right? And we paired that documentary screening with a conversation about women in leadership roles and invited four or five women leaders across different industries in a post-film discussion. You know, that was probably our highest attended screening. And that's just kind of one portion of the things we do. We did an opening for the Grace Jones film earlier this summer, and we paired that with a Grace Jones block party. Our opening for Boom for Real, the Basquiat film, we paired that with a conversation with Jason Jeffers and Franklin Sermons, the director of the Perez Art Museum Miami. We believe that films are the gateway. They're the gateway not just for the arts, but they're gateways to the issues that are facing our community, whether those issues are inclusivity and diversity, whether they are just kind of a celebration of our commonalities and also celebrations of our differences. So going, having that kind of experience is very different than going to your neighborhood theater, just plopping down with some popcorn entertainment, which is fine and great, and I enjoy it too. But we our approach is a little different, and I think that the community has really responded in kind.
Let's finish up by going back in the past a little bit because, we got a lot of Beatles fans here. And I did mention that there was a tie-in. So as you said, you're going to be playing Yellow Submarine for this 50th anniversary that's coming up this weekend. Again, the Beatles came through Miami and, they spent some time here. We have this really fascinating clip. This is from the Beatles appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show, which was in Miami Beach back in 1964.
And now this has happened again last Sunday. On our show in New York, the Beatles played to the greatest TV audience that's ever been assembled in the history of American TV. Now, tonight, here in Miami Beach, teamed up with Hollywood's delightful Mitzi Gaynor, Myron Cohen, comedy stars Alan and Rossi, again, the Beatles face a record-busting audience. Now, before I bring on the Beatles, ladies and gentlemen, here are four of the nicest youngsters we've ever had on our stage. The Beatles! Bring them on!
First of all, I got to say, I love when I hear people back in the day and they talk about Miami.
Right.
Miami. But you know what? Ed Sullivan had a, his show. There was a link here to Miami Beach.
Yeah. That, you know, that appearance was just a few blocks away from where the Byron Carlyle is. It was at the old Deauville, which has been closed now for about a year. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Miami has a rich history, and Miami Beach has a rich history, and the Beatles play a big part of it in the 60s. So it's kind of a nice way of bringing it full circle.
So what do you expect for this weekend, coming back to Yellow Submarine?
We expect a lot of excitement. We expect a lot of singing. We're actually doing two sing-along screenings of the film. So on Saturday, July 21st at 8:30 p.m. and on Sunday at 2:30 p.m., we will have sing-along screenings with the lyrics on the screen. Come kind of get lost.
You know what? I mean, just I've been listening to it the last couple of days as getting ready for this segment, and that song is in my head now. It's there. I can't get it out. So, but it's a great song, and we're going to finish the show with it. So, Corinne Tapp, she's the executive director of O Cinema, which are, you know, again, this amazing place here in Miami Beach. So much history. It's the 50th anniversary of the formerly Byron Carlyle Theater in Miami Beach, which was restored by O Cinema in 2014. And they're screening the iconic cartoon film for the Beatles, Yellow Submarine, again Saturday.
Starts Friday, July 20th, playing for a week. Sing-along screenings, ocinema.org for details.
Perfect. Kareem, as always, thanks so much, man.
Thanks for having us.
And that's the program. Have a great Friday. Have a great weekend. I'm Luis Hernandez. Talk to you next week.